name is John Crist, and I'm with the Fellowship Program here. It's my honor to welcome you to the U.S. Institute of Peace and to today's talk by Professor Shmuel Eisenstadt, who has just joined us last month, in fact, from Israel as a senior fellow. Anyone who has read a textbook in sociology over the last 40 years or so ought to recognize Professor Eisenstadt's name, probably a few other fields as well. He's had perhaps the most distinguished career in political sociology. And Dr. Eisenstadt is Rose Isaacs Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And he has also held prestigious academic appointments at a variety of institutions around the world. He is a tireless thinker and a prolific writer, and we're very pleased to have him here this year. If you want to get a sense of what prolific writer means, I invite you to, when you're done here, go back to your desktops and call up Amazon.com and type in Eisenstadt, S period, N period, and wait, sit back in your seat after you hit return, wait a few seconds and wait for your server to process the request, and then take a look at the full three pages of book titles that come up. These are edited volumes, single-authored books, other material that Professor Eisenstadt has had a hand in some fashion or another, a list longer than the list that most academics have of articles and chapters in books. And these are just the ones that are in English and that Amazon.com knows about. So it's really quite an impressive opus. And this work has not only accrued him a comparably long list of honors and awards for academic excellence, but they are among the most influential writings on a variety of important topics, from the sociology of revolutions, nature of empires, the comparative development of civilizations, the social consequences of large-scale movements of populations, and now more recently, the development of constitutional democracies and the origins of modernity, which I think is the literature that most material from which Professor Eisenstadt is drawing for the talk today most, which is about global forces that are changing Israeli society, changing the nature of the nation state as it responds to transnational actors and to transnational influences in domestic politics, and indeed changing the context in which conflict around the world emerges and unfolds. And that's why we have him here with us in the Institute. We're very pleased that he managed to uproot himself from Israeli academic life for a few months to join us here. I will leave the rest to Professor Eisenstadt, but just take care of one or two small items before we begin, which is to say that first there is a paper that was circulated in conjunction with the event. Many of you have a copy. If you don't, there's one on the table outside. Please help yourself to it. And Shmuel said to me the other day, all of his work is a work in progress. This is especially so I really welcome comments and reactions to the manuscript. Also on the table outside, there's a list of other events in this series of project reports from senior fellows here at the Institute. I hope you'll take it and share it with colleagues, and we'll see you around the table again in the future. Finally, the audio portion of this event is going out over the web, as many of you know, and so there are directions actually on our website about how to send in a message during the talk, I think that covers it.
Thank you very much, John. I would like first to thank you for this introduction. I would like to thank the Institute here for inviting me, having me here, and giving me a very wonderful time here.
The mic.
Actually,
I
have a mic.
Oh, here. Yeah.
Let's try this one.
Yeah. This is a very good thing. So, I for inviting, and Sir Lewis told me that I am, of course, suffering here from two tumultuous period while it's so quiet at home in Israel. So I'm very grateful for this respite to be able to be in an emotional, quieter atmosphere to do some work. The work which I'm doing here, working on here, is a continuation, as John said. I'd like to thank him also for all the help he has been giving me and to be here during this short stay and some work. It's part of an ongoing project, sometimes ongoing for many, many years, which I call now a project on the problem of multiple modernities. Very simply saying, what I was having interested many, many years is to understand the nature, development of modernities, modern societies. I was always very dissatisfied with the view which said that the world will become similar, everything will converge around everything. If you don't hear me, just give me a sign. Everything will converge around one model with small variations. I was very dissatisfied with it, but being dissatisfied is not enough. You have to do something and to examine this. And I've been examining for many years how in different parts of the world different modes of modernity develop. I've been interested very much for some period in Japan as a very distinct, different type of modernity. I've been saying very often lately, especially, that if one wants to really see how different modernities have been and are, one just need not go necessarily to Japan or India or China or whatever, or Islam or Muslim societies. It's just interesting to compare what a certain French ethnographer did in the 19th century, Monsieur Tocqueville, United States and Europe, and see how different they are. But modernities are not only multiple and different, they are also continuously changing. And all modern societies are continuously changing. And what I want to concentrate today in my brief discussion is some of these changes mentioned already by John, especially changes related to the connection between what has been called the term which I don't like. It's a powerful term, very fashionable one, but still I think too glib in some ways, globalization and changes within nation states. And my major question which I'm addressing is not so much what are the nature of globalization. One can say, as many scholars do say, that from the very beginning of modernity it was a global system. From the 16th century it was some sort of global system. The nature of the globality has changed, but it was always in many ways global. But I want to address the problem, how does it affect, what happens today with transformations of the nation state? There have been many, many people claiming that the nation state is disappearing, weakening. It is no longer important, really. There are other things. On the one hand, international corporations, some social movements, migrations, all of them no longer really controlled by the nation states, and the nation state is no longer an important factor. I don't accept this. I think that the nation state is still, or the state, which is built after a model of nation states, which is changing, is still a very powerful actor, probably one of the most powerful actors. Not the only one, but a very powerful one. But there is no doubt that it has been changing very much. How powerful it is, even in the era of globalization, you can see from two different seemingly contradictory manifestations. And there was in East Asia, the financial crisis 3-4 years ago, whatever. It was only through some arrangements between nation states that it could have been regulated. It was only by some arrangements and agreements between some nation states that could have been regulated. It's true, it's a different mode of regulation than existed before. But nation states are not out, but they do change in their modes of operation and and their relations to other forces. Even when we look today at what I think is the most clear evidence of far-reaching institutional changes in the nation-state, the European Union, which is really limiting and changing the nation-states, it is still limiting and changing the nation-states. Nation-states are still a very important factor without which one cannot know what's happening. But I'm not going to deal with these problems. I want to see, as I say, I admit that there are far-reaching changes in the nation-state. More in the model of the nation-state than in some of the institutional realities. But the realities also change. A very strong model of the nation-state as a sort of uniform, homogeneous entity, clear borders, a relatively homogeneous population, homogeneous culturally population, which has been very forceful as a model, very forceful, is being changed. I say as a model, because even during the heyday of the nation-state, there were really very few on the nation-state which really approached this model. I think that in Europe, there were only two such places, more or less approaching this homogeneous model, France, which is well known for this, and Scandinavian countries, which people don't pay attention very much, they are far away somewhere in the north, but they were even more homogeneous in many ways than France, because they, unlike France, which had always problems of religious minorities, you know, and so on, they were Lutheran in 98%, they were much more homogeneous than France. But beyond this, if you look at places like Holland, not to say anything about Switzerland, but even about England or United Kingdom or Great Britain, and just when I use these three words, it already shows you that it's not very clear exactly what are the borders, even before. There was a much greater variety, of course, than the model suggested. And, of course, this variety became even greater once the model of the nation-state expanded beyond Europe. India, which soon, for the last few years, really fascinated by India as the greatest numerically democracy in the world, which is a democracy, despite having been predicted that it will disappear as a union, as a democracy, and despite having, in a sense, everything going against it being a democracy. And yet, it is there. It hasn't fallen apart. It is not maybe a liberal democracy, whatever it means, but it's a very strong democracy. So if you look at India, is it a nation state? What nation is it? What language? What is the uniformity? There is, but it's not certainly something like Scandinavia or France. Japan is again a different story. Everywhere, once you go beyond Europe, it's even more variegated. And also something which has not been fully, this comparison with not only with the United States, what Tocqueville did, the comparison with Latin America would be fascinating. Are Latin Americans nation states? They are states. But are they the same nation state, the same type? But, it's a good question. Maybe David will be telling us this in 2 weeks or something about this. But however great the variety of the nation state, the variability was during the period when the model was so dominant, the model was there. No doubt. It was the model which was sort of accepted, promulgated, willingly or unwillingly accepted through most parts of the world. This has been changed, has been changing. I'll start with two, three very simple illustrations before I go to Israel. I mentioned Scandinavia. I've been visiting Scandinavia for many, many years. My first visit was to Norway in 1949, and I visited very often since. And my clear impression of that period was Norway, there is one Norwegian language, there is one Norwegian whatever, it's a unified, homogeneous country. People sometimes told me there is a dialect town. To come to Norway today, they have, I don't know how many, regional radio stations, each one promulgating a distinct language, dialect, call you want, but they are publicly doing it as part of the of the public, not just private, you know, sort of private murmurings in the family or in the village. It's very public. It's very previously homogeneous nation. It's now less homogeneous. You don't hear very much about this, because then create a great furor beyond Norway. But we all heard, for instance, they'll come back later to the illustrations, I just mentioned them, about the great contestation in France, about the Muslim girls, whether they can, would be allowed or not, or would be allowed to go with their headgear into the way, whatever you call it, into the public schools. And this was something which went beyond the simple sort of administrative things. It was quite clear there was a very important contestation here for the nature of the French collective identity. Another thing which is I found extremely interesting, which many people did not pay attention, two, three months ago, there was published a very interesting report in England by a private commission, but very influential, which made a big furor. It was chaired by, please listen, Professor Lord Professor, whatever you want, Biku Farek. Now, Biku Farek is obviously not a Celtic or Anglo-Saxon name. He's an Indian professor in I don't remember where, in one of the universities. And he chaired a commission which made a report, first of all, on problems of discrimination against minorities and the usual things, very strongly advocating, looking how to minimize, how to overcome them. But he made also another very interesting, and this report made, that maybe it is time to take out the English component from the British collective identity, not to emphasize it so much. Because this English, Anglo-Saxon colleague, if you want, does not speak to Muslims, to Hindus, who are the strong minorities. It makes them feel alien. Now, this recommendation, how to do it, is not very clear, but the very recommendation made a very, very big furor in England. It's still continuing. I just got yesterday, by pure chance, a message from a friend in Jerusalem sent me another part of this controversy going on. Could go on with many other illustrations. Some I will, time permitting, I will give later. But these are all illustrations of some interesting changes. Now, what is the nature of these changes? What does it mean? What is it about? And who are the carriers of these changes? These changes are basically connected, as were many, many changes in Western or non-Western modalities, by attempts, by demands of many sectors, social sectors, social groups, to become incorporated as active participants in their respective societies. Not just as passive citizens, even, although in the 19th century, even problems of suffrage were, of course, very important. But if you look at the labor movement, if you look at other working movements, at other, they were very important. They were, of course, movements which claimed on behalf of various sectors of the population the right not only to become full-scale citizens, something which in this country with accept of the Afro-Americans was not a problem after the Civil War, but it's not only a problem of citizenship, it's a problem of being able to really shape some of the major contours of the respective states. The welfare state, it was initiated or then in Europe, wherever it was after the Second, was an attempt, exactly such an attempt, to imbue the existing society with not just with some new regulations about benefits, but a new vision of society which these groups tried to promote. And this is continuing today, also with some of these illustrations I gave you. But there is a very important difference now, a very interesting difference. There is a difference in the way in which these groups, different new groups, ask to be incorporated and to become active participants in the political scene. And the difference is really that they do no longer accept as given some of these basic premises of the nation state, or the model of the nation state. They do not necessarily want to do away with it, but they change it in different directions. One of such directions, which I just mentioned in passing, is of course what you see, for instance, in Spain, when you see many regions becoming semi-autonomous, and not only the Basques, about whom we hear in the read, but for instance, if I'm not wrong, Catalonia has direct relations today to Brussels, not going through Madrid. So you have here a region developing taking some of the attributes of sovereignty, which before that would be unheard of. And this goes all over in different places and different measures. But this is one way, one aspect of this. But I want to dwell on some other aspects. And now I move to Israel, and I deal with Israel. I want to deal from this point of view of the new modes or the new types of demands for incorporation of different sectors into the nation state. What do they do? What is the nature of these new demands? What is their impact on the national scene? And I shall mention in the Israeli scene three groups. After giving a very I will not give you an historical introduction to the whole period, it will take more than one seminar, but I will mention especially three groups. There are more, rather four groups, which have been, some of which you might have heard about. You heard about all of them, but not always in this context. One group is a new religious, oriental in our sense, Sephardi, what's called party, called Shas. You may or may not have heard about it. You probably heard sometimes, you read in the newspaper about their leader, the Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, and they look something entirely new, different from what we have known in Israel. They're extremely interesting from this point. This will be one group. The second group will be the new immigrants from the former Russian, from the former Soviet Union, which have, in numbers, they came from around, let's say in the last 10, 12 years, close to 1 million, which means they are now 1 million out of a population of 6 and something. Just imagine, do the arithmetics, how many people you would need in the United States proportionately to make such a change. And then you'll see that all the problems of Hispanics and so on here are quantitatively very, very small compared to this. The third group, which is much smaller, but it's very interesting from the point of view of the point which I want, is the mode of involvement of Jews coming from Western countries, the United States, some European countries, the ways in which they become involved in Israeli politics, whether they become Israeli citizens or whether they only work influence from outside. And the last group will be, of course, the Israeli Arabs, Israeli Palestinians, those Arabs. I'm not talking about people in the West Bank, I'm talking about the Israeli Arabs who were there from the beginning of the state and who became not only a very important factor and numerically growing, but also showing some very interesting new directions, new problems. The common denominator of all these groups, the like of which you will find in other societies, not exactly the same, is, as I said, that they challenge in many ways the old premises of the nation state, that they develop many new interstate or international relations, create basically new interstate and international political arenas which impinge on the politics of the nation state in ways which did not exist to that extent before. There was always something of this. Nothing is entirely new under the sun. And even in the classical nation state, there were, of course, several international very important bodies playing a very important political role. For instance, in Europe, there was all the time the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church was an international body, very, very influential in most European countries, not in Scandinavia, but almost in all the others. But this has changed. Today it's gone much beyond what we have seen there. Well, let's look a bit more closer at these four groups in Israel, which I mentioned. This group of the Shas people. this religious Sephardi Oriental. I'm using these terms, that none of them is very accurate or helpful, but what it means, most of the electorate, most of the people who belong to them, have come from families which came from countries which were originally under Ottoman rule. They came from North Africa, from Iraq a bit from Egypt, but it was mostly North Africa, to some extent Iraq, when they came. And they were very heterogeneous groups. They became more homogeneous once the Israeli census decided to call them all of Afro-Asian origin, just like, which is nothing special, the Israeli census, just like it is the census of India under the British, which created the caste categories. The clear caste categories were created by the British, not by the Indians. And they, of course, there were castes before this, and there were Oriental communities in Israel or Jewish communities before, but this clear demarcation is in itself, it's something new. It's creation of this, of the census, the census has always played a crucial role in the homogenization of the nation state. We think it's only the sort of technical device. It's much more than this. It started, interestingly, in Europe, before the clear nation state, by Kaiser Joseph of Austria, son of Maria Theresia. He started to make the censuses in order to able to control in a much more unified way the population than we did before. And the census, as you may see also from the US census, and now every day you can almost read in the newspaper somehow, and see that while it's seemingly only that's objective scientific work, it's much more than this. It's really a very strong instrument of social regulation and categorization. Anyhow, these groups, these Oriental groups, settled in Israel, came after the war, most of them, 95% came after the War of Independence, after the establishment of the state, and it is their children or grandchildren, and I emphasize this point because it's very important, have become the main supporters of this new group. Now, why is it important that I emphasize children and grandchildren? Because this is a purely Israeli product. It is not an import from outside. It worked out, developed purely in Israel. You cannot understand it in any other terms. For instance, some of the non-Sfardi there, Ashkenazi, Orthodox, what we call Haredim, they were modeled for a long period after what existed in Eastern Europe. There was not such model for Shas wherever they came from. This is purely Israeli. That's why it's so fascinating. It came out of the development, the tensions, the problems in Israel itself. Now, what is the unique thing about them? They are, as I said, religious, and we have or had from the beginning a strong religious parties, divided into two types. One was the National Religious Party, which was a strong Zionist party, out of which later, after the Six-Day War, came the what's called the Gush Emunim, the people whom you read in the papers as settlers mostly. And so on. And then there were the Orthodox, who basically never accepted fully the legitimacy of the State of Israel. Because Zionism was opposed by the Orthodox, by the super-Orthodox, because they claimed that it is not the business of the Jews to take their own faith, collective faith politically. Messiah will do it. The Messiah will come and do it. And they never fully accepted it, so much so that one very short exception at the very beginning of the state, although they were wonderful political players and influence and what, whatever you want, the locations and so on, they never agreed to be ministers in the cabinet. They were vice ministers, but not ministers. Power, they had the same. But they did not fully give the legitimation. They were women. About 10 years ago, not 12, doesn't matter, for the first time their convention of this group, which is called the Agudat Israel, which was created in Poland, was in Israel, in Jerusalem, the World Convention. And it was a big event, and they invited everyone, all the secular, whoever you want. There was one person they couldn't invite, nothing personal. And this was the president of the state. Because if they would have invited the president, they would have to stand up, the national hymn would have to be held according to protocol, they wouldn't do it. So they sent a delegation to pay respects, but he was not invited. So they were very powerful political players in terms of their own interests. They did not participate, in a sense, in the formation, in the French sense of the state. If you look at Chas, it's something extremely opposite. They fully accept the state. They accept the army, you know, the other Orthodox, they don't go to the army, there is special arrangements, and so on. The Chas people, most of them go. They also insist on this, that those who want to study Jewish law have to be exempted. But they don't say that everybody has to. And there, most of them go, most of their ministers serve in the army, even if in a sort of very symbolic way, 3 months, 6 months. But legitimacy, in terms of legitimacy, they accept it. They fully accept it. They have no problems to invite the president or whoever, and things of this kind. But, and here comes the very interesting thing, while they fully accept the state of Israel, they don't accept the Zionist symbolism and legitimation of that state. And what they want to develop, and what they try to develop, is an alternative all-Jewish ideology, non-Zionist ideology, as their program and as their new legitimation for the state. They accept the state, but they want to change it, its premises. They are not very successful in changing the premises. And I'll tell you a very amusing sort of anecdote about how they accept and want to change, but anecdote is interesting, but in a minute I'll tell you. But the important thing for me here is that you have here a group fully accepting the nation state, but wanting to change its basic premises and symbols. It is not entirely dissimilar from what has been happening in India. And you have the BJP, the new religious national congress. And in India now they form the government. Shas doesn't form the government, it is a very powerful influence in the government. And part of their influence, part of their ability to mobilize, they have now 17 members of the Knesset, which is the largest number that any religious party ever had, was because of this combination of, on the one hand, acceptance of the state, on the other hand, the promulgation of a radical changing ideology for the state. Which, an ideology which does not accept the sort of, to make it, say it briefly, shortly, the secular elements of Zionism, the idea that you have to have a secular Jewish society. No, it has to be a Jewish society, but not a secular, fully religious, so on. And I tell you this short story, it's a true story, people not often did pay attention to it. One of the, this is very often legitimation, is of course connected to symbols, so symbolic things are of importance in these things. So one of the great symbols in Israel are the days of remembrance, of memory. There are 2 days, one for the Holocaust and one for the fall in the wars of Israel. And they are, in each of these days, there is a siren, warning that everybody has to stand to attention for 2 minutes, traffic stops, and so on. The Orthodox, the Ashkenazi Orthodox, they don't participate. They try to evade this. They don't go to the streets, they try to evade, and if they are on the street, they try not to stand. They don't want to accept it, because they say this is not really Jewish, this is secular, we don't know. Some people from Shas proposed, it wasn't accepted, curiously enough, nobody took it seriously, but the proposal is interesting, that yes, there should be a siren, and so on, everybody should really stand, but pray. You should, during those 2-3 minutes, pray, say a prayer. So it's an interesting combination, full acceptance of the symbol, of the framework, changing the symbol. And it is this combination which makes them very strong. But the symbols are also, and this is something important to remember, and I said it in the beginning, you might not have paid attention to this emphasis, as I said, they are talking about an old Jewish new identity. And they say that the Sephardi identity should be a new Sephardi religious identity, which is promulgated very strongly by this by their leader, should be the overall identity of the state and of all Jewish communities. And they develop many, many relations, very strong networks with other Jewish communities, especially in Europe. You don't see them very much here. You do see some of them in Canada, you can find them. No, but in Europe, they are developing these very strong networks, which then influence also Israeli. So what do we have here? It's a group coming out of Israel, out of the dynamics of Israeli society, of that nation state. That's crucial to remember. It's not something from the outside. Attempting to change radically, not denying the legitimacy of the framework, but to change its basic premises. And working on the in the direction, not always very visible, not always successful, but that's not the crucial point, with other Jewish communities. So before I go to the second direction, as I mentioned already, other Jewish communities, I make a brief state, something brief about what I said before, about the mode of involvement of Jewish communities, especially from the West, in Israeli politics. From the beginning of Israel, there was a strong involvement, support, money, political, and so on. But basically, there was almost 100% acceptance of whatever the government of Israel said. The help that came usually financially through a unified organization, the Jewish United Jewish Appeal, which was then connected with the government or with the Jewish agency. There was no real active participation in political life in Israel except from a symbolic level. We have now two different new developments, extremely interesting. One, many of those who come from especially the United States, a bit from Europe, they have been also pushing in Israel, they become Israeli citizens, for what you would call religious pluralism. Jewish religious pluralism. Because in Israel, it's the Orthodox who really have the monopoly. And they were pushing, and they are pushing, they are fighting to courts, legal actors, legal actions, and so on, for full recognition also of what in this country we call the conservative and the reform, the conversions, so on. The interesting thing here is, this has become a central issue in Israeli politics. It did not come out of internal Israeli dynamics. Little, but not really. It came out of these groups who came, suddenly became part of Israel. That's very interesting how they tried to change again some of this. On the other hand, many Jewish groups now who want to support Israel do not give a sort of unconditional support to general causes. They try, like some of you may have heard about the New Israel Foundation or something, whatever it's called, they try to give to specific projects which they support. Which means, again, a new type of involvement, which is obviously transnational. So we have here two different groups, and yet both of them, in different ways, connecting changes, possible changes in the premises and institutions of the nation state with transnational relations and networks. I think that's a crucial element, if you have this connection. It's not just that something new has been happened. This connection which is very active. And this connection comes out even more interesting, surprising, with the immigrants from the former Soviet Russia. I say advisedly the former Soviet Russia because I don't say only Russia, because in the Soviet Empire, I say not only Russia because we don't have exact statistics, but probably at least 30% of them come from the Asian the Asian communities. They're only there for 10 years, 10, 12 years. And if you look comparatively statistically, it was a story of great success, economically and so on. of course, with great hardships. There's no immigration of that size that you can easily do everything. Many people lost their occupations. There came, for instance, around 10,000 doctors. What could Israel do with 10,000? Each Israeli would get 5 checkups a day. Obviously, many people, especially the older people, could not take it. But still, if you look comparatively, it was a great success. But whatever the evaluation of the success, the interesting thing is that they, of course, greatly changed the whole ambience of Israeli society, as any immigrant goes. But here, it went beyond what you were, let's say, used to, or what you could have seen in this country when you were still talking about melting pots and things of this kind. They changed because they became, the first sort of reaction from older Israelis was, well, they are not really interested in Israel, they are, they want to keep their Russian identity, they don't want really to become Israelis, and so on and so on. Again, you know, something not very unusual in countries of immigration. But very quickly, it became quite clear that the situation is much, much more complex, much more advanced. First of all, yes, some of them, many of them, continue to, they still live, many of them, in relatively segregated ecological neighborhoods. Again, quite natural in any country of immigration. They speak among themselves more Russian. But they also very much promulgate, so on, the importance and even the superiority of the Russian culture over the Israeli culture. So they would come and say, well, in schools you don't study Dostoevsky and so on. You don't participate in this high cultural life that we had. And they had. I mean, if you visited Soviet Russia and so on, I mean, their participation in cultural life was very strong. I remember the first time that we came to Soviet Russia, one of the things that struck us was how many people on the streets in the big cities were reading serious literature on the buses, in the metro, so on. It was a highly, highly educated population in the cities. And cultural events were very free, theater, opera, and so on. And suddenly they see a different, more market-oriented, if you want, situation in Israel. It's a different cultural ambience, and they very want to keep many of it. And it looks, and they want to be able to maintain their distinct, some of these distinctive modes of life and so on, and even to give it to the children. Interesting thing is, they, in the beginning, it looked like something separate, not religious. Very quickly, it became much more complex. First of all, they looked more and more on themselves as Israelis, participating very, very strongly in political life. Became a political party, and they became very active in politics, and taking up, in their own ways, made the major themes of problems of Israeli politics, especially peace, arrangement with Arabs, and so on, but many others also. They got also very much involved with the whole religious question, because many of them were not exactly, it was not clear whether they exactly were Jews according to the rabbinical law, and that they were or were not, but the children went to the army. So what do you do with children who go to the army? Then you deny them the right of being married and so on. So it became a very, very complex problem, a very important problem. But at the same time, they became involved in Israeli politics. They looked themselves in many ways as Israelis, but not necessarily accepting the given frameworks. Not necessarily saying that they will just assimilate in the usual way. They want to create, and they create very new spaces, cultural, social spaces. Some are very visible, for instance, they contributed a lot to the spread of music, the orchestras. But this is good and interesting. But beyond this, for instance, they have now developed from within them a series of schools, new types of schools in which they want, partially in Hebrew, partially in Russian and English, and so on, to make a different curriculum, which would be, they would say, of a higher standard than what you find in the Israeli schools. So they want to, in some way, to participate, but at the same time, to emphasize some distinct identity, which will not be anti-Israeli, which will not be separate, but will be another element in the Israeli, you know, but an element with international, transnational connections in the military theater. And I'll give you one, again, symbolic illustration of their wish, how they want their wish to become fully accepted in Israel. Because of some of their pressures, political, so on, we have now in Israel, I don't exactly know the legal standard, but I think that the May 9th, the 9th of May, is a semi-national holiday. By semi-national, I mean an elective holiday. We have a list of holidays beyond those which are for everybody, like 4th of July and so on, that out of, I don't know, 7 or 8, you can choose 2 more. In the old times, when the socialist labor movement was strong, 1st of May was, of course, a very important thing. It still is such an elective day. The amount of people who participate in it today who choose it is rather small. Another such very interesting elective day is connected with the Sfardi, the day after Passover, when the Mimuna, when the Moroccan community is presented a great festival, and it's become a sort of national festival. What the Russians now, the Russian immigrants demanded, or part of them at least, is the 9th of May will be also. Why? Probably to most of you, the 9th of May doesn't mean very much. The 9th of May is the day when the Red Army the victory of the Red Army over the Nazis in Europe. And they, in this, and many of these veterans, they were from the Red Army. They were veterans of the Red Army. And they still are very proud of this. And they said, we want this to be recognized as a specific Jewish component of contribution to the victory over Nazis. How it has been accepted, how popular it will be, I don't know. But again, the symbolic game is very interesting. It is a game which shows you they want to be part, but infuse their own. But it's not only this. They are also very strongly transnational. Because there is a constant movement, continuous movements, first of all economic thinking, between them and Russia. They go, they forth. Many of those doctors who were not able to become full, they opened up private sanatoriums in Israel to which people from Russia. And they developed these new networks, or the other way around, many things. But interestingly enough, that develops also some interesting connections with other, certainly in research, it's fully, some of my colleagues are doing it very interestingly, with other, what I would call, Russian diasporas. Now, what do I mean Russian by the Russian diaspora? For instance, diasporas in Baltic countries, diasporas in some of the Eastern European countries, especially the Baltics are interesting, Moldavia to some extent, in which there are quite strong, numerous Russian groups which were brought over by the Soviets, which are now citizens of those countries or want to be citizens. At the same time, they want to maintain some of their cultural identity. So, and what is their cultural identity? This is something extremely interesting. It is not really Russian in the narrow sense. It is, in a paradoxical way, Russian Soviet. Not in the sense that they that they worship Stalin, something like this. But what they do is to emphasize very much this idea of a Russian, of a universal culture promoted by the Soviets in the name of Russia. And it no longer exists in Russia itself. They are, very interesting, the diaspora community, they are the promoters. Now this is something which is not peculiar to them. If you look, for instance, at the Islamic diasporas, Muslim diasporas in Europe or even here, they also very often promulgate a vision of their respective cultures, in which is much more representative, much more universal, much more less connected to the specific places, but bearing a much more universal message than you would find in places in which you live, in traditional places. For instance, this Muslim Arabic very strong conception of the Ummah. This has been promulgated much stronger in diaspora communities than in Arabic communities. So we have a very interesting general phenomenon of a new type of cultural identity, transnational, creating, if you should use this phrase, an imagined but very strong set of affiliation. And there is a new type of movement or connections between them. Extremely interesting. I cannot say what will happen with this, how long it will continue, but obviously this is something which is an entirely new development. And I, on purpose, I mentioned all the time this, compared it here with India, here, because it's not something specifically Israel. Specifics of each case are different, of course. But the general trend is over. Of course, this is also true in a much more visible and well-known way with respect to the Israeli Arabs. Those Arabs who, as I said, were there in Israel from the beginning, did not fly away or were not forced to go, remained in Israel. In the beginning, being a very quiet, highly, de facto, in the beginning there was the military regime over them. They were looked at suspicious after the war, with suspicion. Slowly it was opened up, but still there was a continuous relative discrimination in many ways. Like the Orthodox, they didn't go to the army. But they were not invited also to go to the army for obvious, almost obvious reasons. Now this, what is changing now? This has started to change from after the Six-Day War, and especially after the Yom Kippur War. What has changed now is that very slowly and then very quickly and intensively later, the Israeli Arabs started to develop very strong, active political activity with very strong endeavors to find a more place for the collective Arab identity within the framework of Israel, which is not an easy problem. Israel has been declared the Jewish state. The symbols are Jewish. The law of return is with the Jews. And symbolic in some way. It's very, very strongly. Holidays. Arabic is the second official language, but it's not like the French in Canada. Maybe like it was. It used to be in Quebec. But they now have, it's a long process, but now very strong. Also very strongly connected, of course, with the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They have now more and more are working how to work out more collective place for their identity in Israel. But at the same time, sometimes, and some Israelis will tell you, this means they don't want to be part of Israel, they are enemies and so on. But at the same time also trying to find some of them, and they are oscillating all the time, between a relatively strong identification with Israel, but with a different Israel. An Israel which they would like to change. And how successful they will be, it's difficult to know, but there is no doubt that it has been opened up in a way it was not before. The nature of the representation in the parliament, the Knesset, has changed from sort of old traditional and so on. They became very militant, they constitute a very important militant, active element there. Whatever the exact outcome, the very fact that this has been opened up, and this is by definition, of course, trans-state, is another indication of these general trends which I was talking about. Well, the concrete specifics are, of course, the concrete things are specific to each case. And many of the things are specific to Israeli. But some of these things, some of these trends, I think are much more wider. They deal with these changes in modernity, not with the demise of the nation state, but with the transformation of many of its elements and with the growing appearance of international political, transnational, I don't want to say international, because international is very often seen as intergovernmental, so on. I'm saying there are those, of course, but there are also transnational, different political arenas, which are extremely important, of course, you know better than I do. The many NGOs constitute one such element. And this means also that there is a new mode of conflicts. All these developments are not necessarily, as any developments in modernity, they are not only developments towards more benign situations. As any such developments, they contain within themselves the possibilities of more open, but also greater and much stronger, much more intensive conflicts between different groups. But the conflicts are now, and part of the intensification of the conflicts, but maybe also some hope, greater hope for the solution or at least the regulation of them, is that they are no longer entirely limited to relations between states. There are all these new elements, new arenas, which influence the states, which may intensify the conflict very, very, very sharply, but maybe which create also new arenas of possible conflict resolution. But this, I really, is not my expertise, or whatever my knowledge, you probably hear at this institute know much more about it than I. That's what I want to say.
Thank you very much. You pointed out the grand scheme and overarching context here that will allow us to proceed in any number of the various discussion. And I turn to the audience for questions and comments.